It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
No matter how hard we try, it is tough to figure out a way this economy gets better without real estate. Housing hit a bump in the road to recovery today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 18th of November, and it is good to have you with us. We will begin today with the numbers. Not those. We'll get to those later. You know that. The numbers of interest today, though, were about new housing construction and inflation. Inflation-wise, there is still not a whole lot to worry about. The consumer price index rose a modest 0.2%. That's an okay number, given the state of the rest of the economy. Of course, that does lead us back to the housing market. We learned this morning new home construction dropped more than 10% in October. Now, 1 month's shaky numbers do not a double-dip recession make, but the economy did get some high-level attention today, as our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
The surprise downturn was a startling revelation for many economists. It shows just how critical government support remains to the barely budding economic recovery. It's also raising urgent questions about just how long the government can keep this up. David Crow is chief economist at the National Association of Home Builders. He says while Washington wrangled over extending a tax credit for home buyers, nervous builders put construction on hold.
The builders slowed down in production to make sure they didn't get ahead of themselves.
They've cut back, in fact, to their smallest new home inventory in more than a quarter century. Get this, the number of new homes for sale has dwindled to just 251,000, barely the size of some small towns. Congress agreed earlier this month to extend the tax credit, and Crow hopes that will now work its magic, as he puts it, to turn around home sales and the overall economy. But it's just 5 more months, really enough time to rekindle sales. Buyers need to sign a purchase agreement by the end of April to get the tax credit.
After that, we've got to hope that that was the spark and that the economy is starting to move forward, because we've already told the Congress we're not going to come back and ask for more.
President Obama underscored that government support is nearing its limits during an interview today with Fox News.
If we keep on adding to the debt, even in the midst of this recovery, at some point people could lose confidence in the U.S. economy in a way that could actually lead to a double-dip recession.
But today's numbers raise an additional worry. It's not just that the government is nearing its limits, but that the impact of all that stimulus spending might be limited as well. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
You know how we like to look at things like UPS and railroad freight loads when we're trying to get a handle on the economy? The more stuff that's being moved, the better, right? Same principles apply worldwide. One of the telling indicators there is container ship usage. A global recession means demand for those ships has been stuck down in the doldrums, not enough cargo to fill them. Yet over in Asia, some big publicly traded shipping companies are enjoying a boom in their stock prices. We asked Marketplace's Steve Henn to unravel this post-bust paradox for us.
When millions of Americans suddenly stop shopping, Thousands of container ships around the globe are rendered useless. But those ships are still out there, bobbing offshore somewhere, waiting for trade to come back.
Maybe 700-plus container ships sitting idle off the coast of Singapore right now.
Doug Mavranak is a shipping analyst at Jefferies & Company. He says there are few industries in the world that have been hit harder by this recession than shipping. Before the bust, the industry went on a shipbuilding binge. Then trade collapsed, and now most container ships are operating at a loss.
You have such excess tonnage available that it's preventing rates from really rising appreciably, and it should until those 700-plus ships are no longer there.
Mavranak believes the industry is probably years away from any real recovery. So it's odd that a couple big East Asian shipping companies are experiencing a bit of a boom in their stock price. Fred Dahl is an industry consultant.
Vessels, for example, that were averaging, say, $34,000 a day in 2007, are right now being chartered for around $6,500 a day.
With prices that low, Dahl says most firms can't cover costs, and he's expecting a wave of bankruptcies.
People are going to be in some difficulties financially, that's clear.
But low interest rates have set off an investment boom in Asia. In Hong Kong, asset prices are soaring on everything from real estate to shares of stock in struggling firms in an industry still adrift at sea. I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
California banned television sets today. Not all of them, just the big flat screens that use lots of energy. And not right away, either. This afternoon, California regulators decided that starting year after next, flat screens sold out here will have to meet new efficiency standards. Those requirements get more strict by 2013. California says it's just trying to control power use, but the entire industry could wind up playing by the new rules, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Consumers are keeping a tight hold on their wallets this holiday season. One thing they are buying, though, flat screen TVs. Riddhi Patel is an analyst with the research firm iSupply. She says sales of the sets this holiday season will be up around 14% over last year.
This is a product that consumers are willing to spend money on because entertainment has become really important.
Competition for those consumer dollars is cutthroat. The average price for a flat screen set is roughly half what it was last year. And now California's energy efficiency mandate is about to turn the industry on its head, says Yankee Group researcher Carl Howe.
It may reshape the market because California is such a big part of the economy. 13% of the entire U.S. economy comes from California.
Howe says California's energy efficiency requirements will probably mean fewer plasma TVs. They use a lot more power than LCD sets. California's new rules dictate televisions have to consume about a third less energy by 2011. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The stock charts I saw on the teeny tiny little TV in my office today, they were pointing down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Yes, the recession is technically over, and yes, a lot of companies are reporting pretty good profits. But I bet if you stopped 10 people randomly on the street outside this afternoon, most of them would say they are still very much undecided about whether things have really turned around. What gives? Commentator Robert Reich says it's not all that hard to figure out.
How can the stock market hit new highs when unemployment continues to hit new highs? Simple. Corporate earnings are up because companies are cutting costs, and the biggest single cost is their payrolls. So they let people go, and presto, balance sheets look much better, and stock prices rise. In the old-fashioned kind of recession decades ago, big companies laid off people with the expectation of rehiring them when the economy turned up. Then a few recessions back, companies started laying off people for good, never rehiring them, even when the economy recovered. In the Great Recession of 2008-2009, companies are going a step further. They're using the sharp downturn to cut payrolls even below where they were when times were good. Outsourcing abroad, contracting out, replacing people with software and automated machines. Whatever it takes to get payrolls down so earnings bounce up. Caterpillar earned $404 million in the third quarter, or 64 cents a share. Analysts had expected only 5 cents. How did Caterpillar do it? Not by selling more bulldozers, but by cutting over 37,000 jobs. We're having an asset-based recovery, not a Main Street recovery. The surge in productivity is a mirage. Worker output per hour is skyrocketing because, hey, companies are getting almost as much output with fewer workers and fewer hours. The Fed, meanwhile, is collaborating in all this, making it as cheap as possible for companies to axe their employees. Money costs so little these days, it's easy to substitute capital for labor and burnish balance sheets. The Fed, in effect, is placing a huge bet on a recovery driven by asset prices. That's a bad bet. The great disconnect between the stock market and jobs is pushing stock prices way out of line with the real economy. That's not sustainable. No economy can recover without consumers. But consumers facing mounting job losses as well as pay cuts are in no mood to buy and won't be for some time. Now, I'm not predicting a major correction or double dip anytime soon, but watch your wallets.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Take a minute to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. The link to click on is the one that says contact. The data trail that we create every day is only growing. Every time we go online, every time we use our cell phones, companies log our preferences, they make suggestions, and they remember what we do. Even though a lot of consumers have gotten used to that, a lot of businesses are still trying to figure out how to use our data to the best effect. One of the first companies to realize the social potential of consumer data was Amazon.com, and Andreas Weigand used to be the chief scientist there. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
This thing called the social data revolution, what does that mean, really?
Social data for me means sharing data. Sharing data means, think about Facebook, sharing data with your friends, think about Twitter, sharing data with the world.
We all share data, and that's fine, and we're good with that. But your thesis here is that what's happening is companies are getting smarter about how they use it, aren't they?
Yes. I think that we see a split in companies. That those companies which genuinely embrace what the users can do for them, Amazon.com as an example, wish lists where you can actually recommend stuff to your friends, Facebook as a clear example, all these platforms, versus those companies which try to define themselves as traditional companies. Unfortunately, many airlines fall into that category, many banks fall into that category. And as a new generation in the social data revolution grows up, the expectation towards the airline and towards the bank is precisely the same as the expectation towards Amazon or other good companies.
Isn't it supposed to be about, though, not what users can do for the company, but what the company can do for the users?
No, I think it's what users can do for the company, because ultimately, what users do for the company, they do for themselves. So if I tell Virgin America what kind of people like to chat with, maybe implicitly by chatting them up on the flight between here and San Francisco, then they can do something for me by chance having that nice person sit next to me next time I'm taking that flight.
You actually, there's a quote of yours that I read as I was preparing for this talk, where you talk about this thing called explicit data creation. I mean, that's what these companies are trying to do, right?
Yes. So implicit means that you sniff the digital exhaust, that you go behind them and look for the traces. Explicit means that you create incentives for users to share stuff with you. And why do they do this? Well, on the surface, because they want to get some value out of it. Maybe they want to get a camera which fits their needs better or a credit card that suits them more. Deep down, however, I think it is the need for belonging, for self-expression.
Is there an element of this that is vaguely creepy, vaguely Big Brotherish?
It is your choice what data about yourself you're revealing. So as we move from the implicit data collection to a much larger percentage of what you create being explicit data, you are more in control than you have ever been of the bits that you generate. I asked my students at my Stanford course last quarter, what was the most interesting experience you had on any social networking site? And the answer was, fact that we can connect with anybody who we ever met in our lives. So those were grad students at Stanford. If you think about people 10 years younger in their early teens, they would say, what are you talking about? Has it ever been different?
Andreas Weigand is the former chief scientist at Amazon.com. He teaches data mining at Stanford University. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up, how cows might help light up your home.
So we can capture the gas from those cows, and it takes basically two cows to power one average California home.
Moo. But first, let's do the numbers. Those unexpectedly weak housing numbers we told you about weighed on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrial sagged 11 points, a tenth of 1%, closed at 10,426. The NASDAQ lopped off 10 points, that's a half percent, finished at 2,193. The S&P 500 pretty much flat, down just half a point, less than a tenth of 1%. Housing was not the only drag on the market, though. Weak earnings took their toll as well. Business software maker Autodesk lowered its outlook for the current quarter. Shares fell more than 10%. Hewlett-Packard stock lost more than 1.5%. Intel dropped almost 1% today. Bank of America cashed in on an analyst prediction that shares will rise in the coming year. They rose today, too, better than 3.5%. Other financials gained. Wells Fargo stock galloped ahead 1.75% today. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. SunGard Availability Services operates 5 million square feet of secure data center space dedicated to keeping people and information connected. More information at sunguard.com. Marketplace is distributed by American Public Media. For information about underwriting this or other APM programs, such as The Splendid Table, visit AmericanPublicMedia.org. Why is a derivative like a Thanksgiving turkey? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify the worlds of finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee holds a hearing on financial regulatory reform. Is it time to lift the ban on travel to Cuba? The House Foreign Affairs Committee addresses the issue. And we may take them for granted, but about 2.5 billion people are without them. Toilets. Tomorrow is World Toilet Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You might have heard me say the other day that the legislative lineup for Congress for the rest of the season was health care and then financial regulation and then the climate change package. Clearly, I should have checked with Harry Reid. The Senate Majority Leader told fellow Democrats Monday night that he wants to get a jobs bill into the mix after the health care package is passed. Another way to say jobs bill is stimulus package, which happens to be the topic of David Leonhardt's column in The New York Times today. David, good to talk to you again.
Nice to be back, Kai.
What can we say about stimulus and jobs that have worked so far that the government's done?
I think the short version is that the stimulus has worked, but it hasn't been enough. There are little stories about stimulus that doesn't work or stimulus that hasn't been enacted yet, and those stories are true. But if you look at the overall effect of stimulus, the economists, private economists who have looked at this, have come up with estimates of somewhere between 700,000 and 1.5 million jobs that would not exist today were it not for the stimulus. That's a huge help. It's obviously not enough, given that our unemployment rate is now above 10%.
Right. So how much more now can Congress and the White House and government in general do to get that unemployment rate down and get the millions more jobs that this economy needs?
Well, we should hope that the private economy, absent government, is now going in the right direction, that job losses seem to be shrinking just about every month. And so we can hope that by the middle of next year, we have job growth, even if the government did nothing. But there's a lot of reason to worry that it's not going to be particularly good job growth. And so given how many idled resources there are, plants, offices, people, it makes a lot of sense to think about some more stimulus. And it, again, is not going to solve the problem. We had the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, and that brings a really long hangover.
And in fact, you write about one of them in the paper today. It's basically a weatherization stimulus program, right? You call it cash for caulkers. Explain it to us.
Yeah, that's the term used by John Doerr, a venture capitalist who is really pushing this program. President Clinton, former President Clinton, is also pushing a version of it. The idea is to give people incentives to weatherize their home, the same way we gave people incentives to trade in their gas guzzlers and buy more fuel-efficient cars. And I do think it's promising because there are a lot of changes that people could make to their homes that in the long term would save them money. And getting them to make those changes now would stimulate the economy. It would also help people in the long term. The question that I raised in my column today is, weatherizing your home, which I've tried to do recently, is a lot more complicated than buying a car. So I think if the government's going to do this, it has to really make sure that it's a simple program and you make it very clear precisely what people are being given incentives to do.
Well, and the other thing, since you brought up your personal experience in the column, you say, you know, it'll cost plus or minus $4,500 for you to do your home and to weatherize it. But it's going to save you $400 a year, which means you have to be in the house 11 years to make it worth your while, and you're not sure you're going to do that.
That's right. So one of the things that a cash for caulkers program could do is pay me to make that change now. So if I got $2,000 in new stimulus money, then it would cost me only $2,500, and then I might be willing to do it. One of the other intriguing ideas out there, New York State legislature just passed something on this, is an idea where you let people build the cost of their weatherization into their long-term property tax bill. So if I did that, I would be paying part of it, but if I sold my house within the next few years, the next owner would also be paying part of it.
Connect the dots for me, though. How does this, you getting weatherization in your home, how does that create jobs, which is the point of any stimulus package?
The idea really is to get people to spend money that they wouldn't otherwise spend, whether it's businesses or consumers. And right now, there are hundreds of thousands of people who used to be employed in the housing boom, construction workers, contractors, who are out of work, and they're on the sidelines of the labor market. And if we have some significant increase in the number of people who are, for example, weatherizing their homes, you put some of those people back to work.
David Leonhardt, he's an economics columnist for the New York Times. David, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
So far this week on our series, The Climate Race, we've been to the UK and to China, taking a look at how those countries are trying to maximize their green technology profits. Whether next month's climate change meeting in Copenhagen comes up with a substantive agreement or not, the environmental economy is set for a boom to the tune of trillions of dollars worldwide. The United States doesn't really regulate greenhouse gas emissions at the moment. Many American businesses oppose a global treaty that would do that, as well as a law curbing emissions here at home. But some do embrace the idea, including the West Coast Power Company, Pacific Gas and Electric. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
When PG&E talks about making electricity from natural gas, its customers probably don't know just how natural some of it is.
These are Holsteins. They're actually very happy cows.
Renee Ripshin works for Bioenergy Solutions. Her company is selling PG&E what they casually refer to as poo power. And they make that power by capturing the methane gas from cow manure, cleaning it up, and feeding it directly into PG&E's natural gas pipelines.
So one average Holstein will produce around 120 pounds of manure every day. And so we can capture the gas from those cows, and it takes basically two cows to power one average California home.
Every day. Now, that's renewable. But cow power isn't the only renewable energy PG&E is buying these days. In the last few years, it's been aggressively signing contracts for wind, solar, and geothermal power, too. The idea is to cut its emissions of gases that trap heat and cause global warming. The utility's exploring more sci-fi sort of stuff as well. CEO Peter Darby.
One, a satellite-based system where there would be solar collected in space and then transmitted down via microwave. And that certainly would be an exciting breakthrough if it can be accomplished.
But PG&E can afford a little California dreaming. See, this West Coast utility has never depended on coal, the country's biggest source of global warming emissions. The natural gas it uses for almost half its power supply is much cleaner. It also uses a lot of nuclear and hydropower. The state's year-round sunshine makes solar power viable. Add in a CEO convinced that global warming's a real danger, and you've got a recipe for a greener American power company. But PG&E's not going green just because it can. In California, it's the law.
PG&E is a highly regulated company, and its regulators and its ratepayers want the company to do more to control emissions of warming gases.
That's David Victor. He's a climate policy expert at the University of California, San Diego. Victor's referring to a California law that requires utilities to get at least a fifth of their electricity from renewable energy by next year. By 2020, they'll need to get a full third from renewables like solar and wind. Other states have similar mandates, but California's is among the most aggressive. CEO Peter Darby admits it's been a driving force in PG&E's green evolution.
From my own standpoint, I think 33% is a significant challenge, but we have 10 years to pursue it. I think there's a very reasonable likelihood that we will achieve it.
PG&E is also motivated by a sweeping California law that will ultimately make industries pay for the heat-trapping gases they spew. PG&E actually lobbied for that bill, and it supports similar legislation in Congress. CEO Darby would like the feds to flex their muscle even more when utilities need to build new transmission lines for green power.
And say, yes, we're going to put this in place. We understand it may not be entirely popular with every little locale, but it's in the best interest of the state, the region, and the nation.
So if a utility as big as PG&E can get religion over green energy, what's stopping so many other American businesses? Well, lots of utilities and other big companies don't have the luxury. Many depend on coal, an industry that also provides hundreds of thousands of jobs. Dan Esty heads Yale's Center for Environmental Law and Policy. He says the gas, coal, and oil industries see their economic survival at stake and have spent big bucks to defend their dominance.
And they've done it in a variety of ways, traditional lobbying, creating kind of a false impression of lack of clarity around the science. And they've done it the old-fashioned way with big campaign contributions.
Esty says these efforts to protect the jobs and profits these industries have now have effectively held back American innovation.
And there's a real risk that the United States, which has led so many of the recent economic trends, such as information technology, could well be left behind in the race to move to a clean energy future.
A race companies like PG&E say they want to win. In San Francisco, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
If you want to see the consequences of climate change for yourself, you ought to check out the slideshow that's on our website. The photo agency Knorr Images has put together an exhibit that's going to debut at the Copenhagen meeting. Our website is marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Mars. For generations, Mars has been making real chocolate from 100% pure cocoa butter. More at MarsHealthyLiving.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, a word from the world of healthcare before we go. The Congressional Budget Office has added up all the costs and benefits in the Senate's reform bill. The Senate staffer leaked the total to the wire services this afternoon. 31 million Americans will get healthcare coverage who didn't have it before at a cost of $849 billion over 10 years. Also, thanks to the magic and mysteries of government accounting, the bill will also somehow reduce the federal deficit by $127 billion over that same 10-year period. More to come on that one, I'm sure. But for now, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 11 points, about a 10th percent. The Nasdaq shed 10 points, about a half percent. The S&P 500 lost just a half a point. That is obviously less than a 10th of 1%. Mahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gwartz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, early word on the business news of the day, and on Marketplace tomorrow afternoon, what works and what doesn't in the climate race.
Government funding does not work, period. There's a disappearance of money. For whatever reason, it never ends up getting spent on the project it's supposed to be spent in.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for all of that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.